From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, we'll explore some major issues affecting our state. Before he tested positive for COVID-19, State Treasurer Dale Falwell already was issuing warnings about surprise medical billing. You'll hear highlights from a pre-coronavirus conversation on the topic. We'll also tackle other aspects of the pandemic. Businesses across the state have been hit hard. We'll explore the impact specifically for North Carolina restaurants and hotels. Parents of school-aged children across North Carolina have been affected by school closings. You'll hear reaction from one of those parents, the state superintendent. The federal government already has committed more than $2 trillion to relief packages linked to COVID-19. A North Carolina-based budget expert takes a closer look at the federal efforts. And we start the program with another angle on COVID-19. This is the Carolina Journal headline. The COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic continues to disrupt lives across North Carolina. The government has ordered most of us to shelter in place. Is that order justified? How would we know? How long can this last? How long should it last? Joining us now to delve into those questions is the John Locke Foundation's CEO, Amy Cook. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
So this is a tough time for everyone. We all know that we've got this pandemic we're dealing with, and people don't want to create or add to the health crisis. But this is really smacking down the North Carolina and U.S. economy, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think for most people, you know, right now we're just trying to get through our daily lives. I talk to friends and neighbors, and everybody is trying to do their part, shelter in place, social distancing, a word nobody had ever heard of or a phrase no one had ever heard of a few weeks ago. But I also think that people are starting to look forward. They want to know when does it end? We want to plan our lives. This sort of shelter in place for how long? It's currently through April 30th. But, you know, you read reports or hear reports, and will it go longer? I think people really want some kind of a timeline, a time frame, also a little bit more certainty. Clarity, I think, is probably the best word.
Yeah, when it's uncertain and you're sheltering in place and basically don't know how long it's going to last, that makes it much worse than saying, all right, we know that by X date, things are going to at least start to get back to normal.
Right. And you know, it brings up a good point because we're coming into summer, right? I mean, summer, believe it or not, is right around the corner. And you think about, do we continue things like vacation plans? I just bumped a meeting out that was supposed to be the 1st of April, bumped it out to June because I'm thinking I'm not even certain about May. We don't know. So we bumped it out to June. Is that going to be okay? I always have rose-colored glasses. I am an eternal optimist. And the song that keeps going through my mind, for those who are old enough to remember, Maureen McGovern's There's Got to Be a Morning After. So it has been said that I have the best taste in the world's worst music, which means AM hits of the 60s and 70s. But I keep thinking there's got to be a morning after. Like, so when do we get through the storm? When can we start seeing some daylight?
Yeah, number one hit in the early 1970s.
You remember, too.
I do remember that song growing up listening to AM radio. This is a situation where one of the things that we look at is what is the government's plan? Because we, other than sheltering in place and continuing to shelter in place, we really haven't heard much of a plan or, as you've discussed before, an end game. What's the end game here?
Yeah, how do we start coming out of this? I realize that elected officials are grappling with an unprecedented virus right now, and it's a difficult situation. I would also say, though, they campaign to be the person to be in that position, no matter what arose. They were the people who wanted to be there. I'm not saying that they wanted this. I'm just saying they are our leaders. So two things. One, you have to deal with right here and now. What's going on right here now? Also, the future. What do contingency plans look like? Should the epidemic look in North Carolina like it does, God forbid, like it looks like in New York? So far, North Carolina has done a phenomenal job of not replicating New York. But I think at some point we want to know, okay, so when we do reopen for business, what does that look like? Businesses can plan. Let's say, how do we roll it out? Certainly, I have to believe that our leaders are starting to think about that. And I think it would be something that people that are sheltering in place right now or staying at home, that they can hold on to. This constant drumbeat of stay at home, stay at home. You got the Durham mayor showing up at somebody's house, knocking on the door. Hey, you're not social distancing. That may or may not be true, but give people something to look forward to. What does the daylight start to look like?
We are chatting with Amy Cook, who is CEO of the John Locke Foundation. And even though most everything is shut down, if you hear a little bit of background noise, that's because we are chatting from a studio beneath where some economic activity is going on, people banging some hammers and doing some construction work. And that's something we would like to see a lot more of sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. This is it. There was nothing. I guess it was eerie is the best way to put it. Remember when 9/11 happened and then the world was so quiet. There was no economic activity. I think about it probably in North Carolina with a hurricane and everything. All of a sudden, economic activity just ceases. And it is so incredibly quiet. It's we'll go, the hustle and the bustle and the traffic and the noise and everything else. But actually, all of that, as annoying as it is a signal, it's a sign of economic activity. So the guys and the gals, by the way, I've seen some gals up there with hard hats on, slinging a hammer. Seeing them work is encouraging. We want to see that. We want people to be back being productive.
Now, as we see an end game come forward, what is it that you're hoping to see that would give you a signal that, yes, we're on the right path, or raise a red flag that, no, this doesn't sound like what we want?
I'll tell you, if we can see rollbacks in regulation, if we see where we unleash innovators to do what they do best, which is create jobs, start businesses, make it easier for businesses to get, up and going. Some of the restrictions we've seen on to-go products, let's keep that going, because people aren't going to immediately, flip a switch and show up in a restaurant. Let's keep some of those things in place. Instead of reinstituting con laws on hospital beds, let's take out the certificate of need laws for everything in medicine. Let's keep telemedicine going, not just throughout the state, across state lines. Let's make it easier for parents to choose an online educator. Some parents may look at this and say, you know what? I actually enjoy homeschooling my children, and I found an educator in another state who does a great job. Let's open that up. This is really the best moment to deregulate and spur innovation that I've seen in my lifetime.
Yeah, in fact, it sounds like this is a good time to reassess much of what we do and ask, how many of these things do we do just because we always have, and there perhaps could be some different way of doing the same thing?
I think you'll start seeing a trend maybe on Twitter or social media or just sort of out there in the lexicon, hashtag never needed. Did we ever really need this in the first place? Why did we do it? Were we doing it to satisfy a special interest? rather than what's best for the general public or for individual freedom, economic freedom? Why did we do it? Well, you may find out you never really needed it in the first place. Education and healthcare are probably the two primary places where we will see it.
Well, we know that as this process moves forward, one person who's going to be monitoring very closely is Amy Cook. She is CEO of the John Locke Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted every business. Restaurants and hotels certainly have felt the blow. Lynn Minges is president and CEO of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association. She recently discussed the impact with the John Locke Foundation.
Today, across North Carolina, there is no place in the entire state where an individual can go into a dining facility and be served and eat. We're operating on a limited basis where folks can still get takeout and delivery and curbside service in some locations. But that certainly has changed things for our industry, and it's pretty dramatic. I think speaking to the hotel side, we're beginning to just feel the impact of all of this, where we're seeing many hotels choose to close. Others are operating on such limited occupancy that they are, you know, really on life support, just trying to get by. Most of them have laid off staff, and it's really heartbreaking to hear the stories of hotel owners and operators, as well as restaurant owners and operators. But particularly difficult is to hear the stories of the workforce.
Mitch just offered some numbers.
The North Carolina hospitality industry is huge. We comprise about 13% of our state's workforce. In North Carolina, we have 18,000 food service establishments. We have 1,800 lodging establishments. Of those 18,000 food service establishments, all are really shut down today, and that's about 500,000 workers. At least 75% of those are probably unemployed today.
Federal relief is forthcoming, but there is a hitch.
They're very complicated, hard to understand. I spend a lot of my time just trying to understand what they mean. And even when they pass, there is a delay in the time that that law becomes law and the time that it's actually implemented. Rules made and guidance documents in place by folks like the U.S. Department of Labor, the Internal Revenue Service, and others. And so we continue to seek clarity on what these programs really mean and what impact they will have on North Carolina workers as well as businesses.
Just how bad is the situation for North Carolina restaurants and hotels?
I will say that our industry is in peril today. With restaurants essentially closed down statewide and hotels essentially closed down statewide, it's having a devastating impact, not only on those 20,000 businesses that are abruptly changed, but also on the workers, you know, 550,000 of those, the majority of which find themselves unemployed. So that is devastating. We've seen the cancellation of sporting events and concerts and all kinds of public performances. All of those big groups that had planned to be in our state have canceled, and many of them are continuing to stay canceled because we just don't know when the end is in sight. We don't know what that means. And so many of these folks have empty books, empty dance cards right now. And that's concerning to businesses who are used to, you know, having business on their books for some period of extended time. Also of concern is the fact that workers are now working from home. And so we don't have business travelers who are, you know, using our hotels for that purpose. And they're not eating out in restaurant meals. There are folks who are not eating out lunches as they did when they worked full time. And so I really think we are seeing kind of a tsunami of effect on restaurants and hotels across the state. And so the question is, you know, when will we emerge? How will we emerge? Will we emerge? No doubt our hospitality industry is strong. And so when this pandemic is behind us, we will be poised and ready to build and grow and serve again. But until that happens, it's fair to say that we're in, you know, we're hurting. We're in pretty sad shape.
That's Lynn Minges, head of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association. She spoke recently to the John Locke Foundation. Will this pandemic kill off some businesses in the hospitality industry?
I think we are seeing, unfortunately, the end of some restaurants and of some hotels as they may fall into foreclosure. People generally think that just because a hotel or a restaurant is flagged with a big brand name behind them, that they are corporately owned, but that is not true. Across North Carolina, hotels are owned by small businesses, small business owners. I work with them. I see them every day, and they just don't have the cash to maintain. Many of them, and I don't think it discriminates by size or location, many of them will close and may not come back unless relief comes and comes very quickly. And then second of all, on the restaurant side, they are, they're cash strapped right now. That's the biggest concern that we hear from them. Even some of my larger members are telling me that they just don't have money to pay their bills, and they're not paying their bills right now. And so they face, you know, foreclosure. If they're leasing, they face eviction. There's no relief from that. They have utility bills due. The restaurants that are operating today with delivery and takeout and curbside are literally using the cash that comes in to pay their workers, and no other bills are being paid. And so, you know, that is a concern. They need cash today in order to sustain. And some of those that have shuttered and already closed will not come back. We will be different when we come out of this, for sure.
Some businesses are finding ways to stay afloat.
I have been just so heartwarmed and impressed by the creativity and the resilience of many restaurateurs across the state as they have pivoted and changed from the service that they know and deliver every day to a different model. Many of them are doing creative things like, lasagna trays to be taken out. They're changing their menus. They're doing things that folks can take home and finish off themselves. And in some cases, some are offering things like groceries in their restaurants today. So you can literally take home a bag of potatoes. So they're being extremely creative, but it's a new day, a new way of operating. It's not a sustainable model. It's life support to keep some of these lights on, some of these businesses operating, even though it's in a limited fashion, and to keep some of our workforce together.
What do businesses need to keep going?
First and foremost, businesses are cash strapped. One of them told me this morning that she owes today about $500,000 in taxes. And so she knows that those taxes are due, but what we'd like to see is a deferment of those taxes. And so if I could buy 30 days, 60 days, 90 days until those taxes are due, that would give her money today in her pocket to operate, to continue operation, so that she could delay that tax. And then when the money comes, the federal relief comes, she could then remit those taxes. We're not asking for a forgiveness of taxes. This is not anything that's really going to cost the state much money, but we just defer some payment. So that's really what we think could help today.
Could regulatory changes help the situation? Minges cited one example.
Many of our restaurants who derive a large amount of their revenue from alcohol sales, for example, are questioning why they can't sell mixed drinks on a takeout basis. And, right now that's not allowed by law in North Carolina. We're seeing some states around the nation relax those laws. There is interest in folks of getting a mixed drink and being able to take that home and consume it or consume it in a park or somewhere remotely away from people in a safe distancing sort of way. If that regulation were changed, that would certainly be an influx of revenue for restaurants.
What's the long-term outlook for North Carolina's restaurants and hotels?
Well, the longer this continues, the greater the peril many of these businesses face. They may be able to cobble together enough to survive for 30 days. 60 days becomes that much more complicated, and 90 almost insurmountable. And so unless there's some funds, some way for them to pay their lease, many of them have leases on their restaurant equipment. And so they're not able to make those leases. And so they face eviction, foreclosure. They face the fact that many of their restaurant supply, equipment may be taken away. They have all kinds of payments due, and they worry that, they won't be able to make those payments. And so a lot of them are deferring. They have to defer payments to all kinds of vendors. And, there's only a certain amount of time they can continue to do that until they, just can't come back from it. The longer this drags out, the more and more critical it becomes, particularly to extremely small independent restaurant owners and operators.
That's Lynn Minges, president and CEO of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association. She offered the John Locke Foundation a recent update on the COVID-19 pandemic's impact on the state hospitality industry. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted lives of people across North Carolina, especially parents of school-age kids. One of those affected? The state superintendent of public instruction, Mark Johnson. He recently described how the statewide school closing affected his 7-year-old daughter.
My daughter's teacher got their first grade class together using a video chat. And it meant a lot to that group of first graders who themselves are working through what all this means emotionally to them. Knowing her teacher, my guess is it's probably the first time she's ever used Zoom, but she has become very familiar with it, and she's done that very quickly. And that great work is happening all across our entire state.
Schools across North Carolina are adapting to changes linked to the coronavirus. Johnson offered advice for parents as well.
My message to parents, if you haven't already, now is the time to start a routine with your child. We cannot treat this as a long break. Your child does not have to master calculus at home, but help keep them engaged in their learning. Wake up at a reasonable time every morning. Work on remote learning and read and write for a few hours every day. Go outside. Social distancing does not mean you can't get fresh air. And go to bed at a reasonable time. Set a schedule and stick to it. That is exactly what my wife and I are doing with our 7-year-old daughter. For remote learning, you will be getting a lot of options from teachers, and we have even established a website with all kinds of resources. But every chance I have gotten, including now, I have highlighted one resource in particular that my own daughter is using. And it has amazing resources for remote learning for every student in every grade, from our early learners to career exploration and personal finance lessons for high school students. And it's completely free. It's called Khan Academy, and it's spelled khanacademy.org, khanacademy.org. It's one of the most advanced remote learning tools, and it's free.
Johnson thanked teachers and parents for their response to the school shutdown.
In front of you today are state leaders who are also parents. Parents of children who range in ages from young learners all the way to college graduates. We understand how difficult this is, and we are grateful for the work and the sacrifice that educators and families are all making in these unprecedented times.
That's State Superintendent of Public Instruction Mark Johnson speaking during a recent news briefing about the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Facing an unexpected health emergency is bad enough. It gets worse if you end up facing an unexpected bill connected with your medical treatment, sometimes adding up to thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars. One person who's focusing attention on surprise medical billing is North Carolina's State Treasurer, Dale Falwell, who joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm sorry it's on a subject that I know is important to your listeners, because everyone I talk to has their own horror story about medical billing.
Yeah, and this is something you had to deal with yourself. Tell us about that, how you had firsthand experience with this.
Well, last year, like many other North Carolinians on the state health plan, went in for my annual physical, and I live in Winston-Salem, and I came home about 4 or 5 weeks after I received a physical, and my wife was looking at a bill for $10. It was just $10. And she said, "Do you know what this is for?" And I said, "Well, I haven't had any medical attention this year except for this physical." And so she starts to investigate. It's just for $10 now, Mitch. And we end up calling the billing department of the hospital. And the hospital said, well, it was for a doctor visit on a certain day at a certain time, a certain place. And I had the person on speaker, and my wife looked at the calendar. She said, well, that's the time and the place that he had his annual physical. And they said, yes, ma'am, that's correct. And she said, well, we already have a bill for the physical. What is this one for? And the person said, well, somewhere in the conversation in the doctor's office, we can't tell which, but either your husband asked the doctor something or the doctor asked your husband something that was outside the scope of a physical. And we have the ability to charge people for a separate office visit when someone asks a question outside a normal physical. And what I've learned since then is there's all these strange words that there's no way the average person would know what they meant, that people are supposed to abide by. And whatever you do, don't deviate from those words, because if you do, you could be charged for a separate office visit while you're being charged for another office visit at the same time, at the same place, with the same doctor.
And you mentioned the important piece of this, which is no normal person would know not to do this. This is only if you really have studied this and are expert on the ways of medical billing, isn't it?
Exactly. And most people would just pay the $10 and move on with their life. But since my wife knows that, you know, we've been fighting this cartel-like billing in the state health plan for the last 2 years, she decided to investigate. And it's an opportunity not only to applaud her, but applaud all the state employees and retirees. The answer to these questions rest in their hands. And that you get that by being a consumer of healthcare. And we're trying to make it easier so that people can know exactly what they're consuming for healthcare. But what I failed to mention, it wasn't just $10. It was about a $300 charge to the state health plan. That's the key component. And when you look at what ate your pay raise, and this is a big article that was in the New York Times a couple of years ago for public service workers. What ate your pay raise? What ate your cost of living adjustment? It's these issues associated with runaway health care cost.
We are chatting with State Treasurer Dale Falwell. And you mentioned that for you, had you let this go, would have been an extra $10 charge to you, $300 charge to the health plan. Multiply this by many, many people, and you're talking about a lot of billing that doesn't need to take place, right?
Yes. Between the health care, the prescription drugs, and the pension, we're spending about $750 million every 30 days.
Every 30 days?
Every 30 days at the treasurer's office. Not for health care and pharmaceutical benefits for all citizens, just for those on the state health plan. So this is a very serious concern. And, you know, anytime you want to solve a problem, the first thing you got to do is stop digging. And then secondly, it's a little bit like an ant eating a ham biscuit. It's one bite at a time. It's one inquiry about a $10 charge per visit. And, you know, that's all we've been trying to do at the treasurer's office the last 3 years, is to push the power down to the consumer. You know, tomorrow, for people my age, Mitch, is Senior Citizen Day at Food Line. Thursday is Senior Citizen Day at Harris Teeter. You know, people know how to consume if you give them the tools to do so. And this is a situation, and everybody uses the word nonpartisan, but let me tell you, if you watch every minute of the Democratic presidential debates, as I have, and you hear what the President of the United States is saying about this, every person running for the presidency of the United States is talking about the necessity for transparent health care. And it probably ties back in, even though they don't quote him, to the most legendary investor of our lifetime, Warren Buffett, who employs hundreds of thousands of people, who said that rising health care costs are the tapeworm on the U.S. economy.
You mentioned that as treasurer, you've been working on this issue. Remind us about the initiatives that you're working on to try to make sure that we get increased transparency and fighting things like surprise billing.
Well, what we've been trying to do is to go to the Clear Pricing Project, and I think your listeners have seen this before, or viewers, more importantly. This is the price list that was sent to me by UNC Healthcare when I asked them what I was getting for the $300 million that we spent with them in 2018.
And for those who are just listening and not seeing it, what you're seeing, what he's showing me is a bunch of pages that are completely black because they don't show anything.
This is supposed to be the master charge list of UNC Healthcare, 146 pages that are completely blacked out. And as you said earlier, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take advantage of the buying power. You referenced a couple times the state health plan. Let me put this in context. There are almost as many people in the state health plan than work for these three companies combined. Berkshire Hathaway, owned by Warren Buffett, J.P. Morgan, run by Jamie Dimon, and Amazon, run by Jeff Bezos. If you add up the number of people that domestically work for those three companies in the United States, That's about the size of the state health plan. And there's no reason on behalf of those teachers and those troopers, those that teach, those that protect, and those that otherwise serve, that we shouldn't be getting the benefit of that buying power for the benefit of those people who teach, protect, and serve.
As we're speaking right now, where do things stand with this transparency effort and what needs to happen?
Well, where it stands nationally is, as I said earlier, every person running for the presidency of the United States is talking about this. I think Senator Elizabeth Warren said recently that in the last debate that there are 37 million people in this country who went to the doctor and got a prescription that they could not afford to fill. So it's not just Senator Warren, but it's Senator, former Vice President Biden, Senator Sanders, President Trump. And so what's happening is that, you know, those folks are talking about this on a national level, but what we're trying to do as Keeper of the Public Purse of North Carolina is we're trying to operationalize this. And just for your listeners, to bring them up to speed, last year we offered the major hospitals in this state 100% profit, nearly 100% profit. Now, these are nonprofits. We offered them 100% profit. And they said, no, thank you. And so what we do have, specific to your question, is we have 25,000 providers of health care who've said yes.
Someone is going to continue to work on these issues is our state treasurer, Dale Falwell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the part that you play in getting this message out.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has generated multiple relief packages from the federal government. That includes the $2 trillion CARES Act. Joining us now to assess the federal pandemic relief efforts is Joseph Coletti. He is senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation. And Joe, we know that you spend most of your time looking at dollars and cents and how these government programs work at the state level. This time, you're focusing your attention on what's happened on Capitol Hill. See some reasons for red flags or alarms.
Anytime that you start talking about spending in trillions of dollars, there's concern. The latest bill is $2 trillion. The deficit before any of this was $1 trillion. And so you're tripling the amount of the deficit for the federal government already. On top of that, there's already talk of a fourth bill to help cushion the blow to the economy from the virus and the quarantine. And the Federal Reserve has been taking extraordinary steps as well. And so the massive expansion and Luigi Zingali's, one of my favorite economists, writing in the Wall Street Journal recently, actually called the CARES Act one of the greatest acts of centralization and one of the greatest threats to capitalism as we've seen it.
In looking at this, there are some elements, of course, that have to be done if you're going to have a relief effort, because we know folks are hurting. As you look at these bills, how much of them seem to be addressing the issues that ought to be addressed, and how much of it seems to be, well, I'm not quite sure what this is supposed to do. It just seems like it's spending a lot of money.
In the middle of one of these, it gets harder to see where that line falls. But there's a lot in the gray area, a lot of it pretty dark gray. The most important pieces of the three bills that have been passed, the first bill was pretty much entirely focused on COVID. That one was $6 billion for development of a vaccine, $2 to $3 billion for states and local governments to be able to respond. The second bill started to drift into some things that you questioned, right? That paid family leave, not a bad idea, but how do you implement that and the role of the government in that instead of just making that an additional cost on businesses, and how long does that stay afterwards? And so that one starts to get questionable. But Medicaid in that bill was increased. The federal Medicaid match was increased by 6%. And so that's a good thing for states, because that's for the vulnerable people in the population, that's where a lot of the spending is going to happen. In the latest bill, the $377 billion aimed at small and mid-sized businesses, which are mostly loans and forgivable loans, if they keep employment, that's a great thing. Some of the caveats in there are that businesses not only can they not use that money to buy back stocks, but they also can't use that money to pay dividends. And they then can't, if they're receiving a federal loan, they can't oppose unionization of their workers, which we're starting to see efforts of that at Amazon and at Instacart and, you know, in that balancing there. The money for families and individuals, the tax credits, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that, but that's positive. The unemployment compensation, the increased unemployment compensation is a good thing, but the amount of it is potentially dangerous, because the federal bill, the CARES Act increases unemployment insurance payments by the federal government $600 a week. And so when you take a look at somebody who's earning the $15 an hour, that's what they earn in a month. And so you add that on top of the state unemployment benefits, which are going to continue, and you end up with a person potentially getting $900 a month from unemployment. $900 a week from unemployment. Thank you. Which is 50% more than they could earn if they were getting $15 before taxes. And then that's leading to, when people are talking about the fourth COVID bill, they're talking about potentially putting wage subsidies in there to offset the fact that they've increased unemployment benefits so much. And so things like that start to become worrisome. And then you have the money for the Kennedy Center and for larger companies that just start to look like giveaways instead of focused on this. And when you have $2 trillion, that's going to fall in there.
We're chatting with Joe Coletti, who is senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation. Because this is being passed in the middle of a crisis, when people want to see government do things to help those who are suffering, how much danger is there that a lot of the package is going to end up being things that are someone's wish list rather than something targeted to the actual problem?
Yeah, fortunately, Congress was better than they could have been, and better than the House wanted to be. The proposal,
basically wanted the Democratic Party's wish list.
Yeah,
right?
It was a 1,400-page bill. This one ended up being 800 pages, but it was basically, how do we put in legislation everything that the Democrats have always wanted? Green New Deal elements, the PRO Act, which was to make it easier to unionize, was in there. It was kitchen sink. And so what's passed is large and larger than it should be. Hopefully there's continued restraint, but the longer this goes on and the more spending that is desired from Washington, the greater the danger becomes.
As you look at what has already been passed or what could be passed in the future, are there some things that you see that you say, okay, if government's going to do more, do this?
Yeah. And, The main things on that side are the how do you keep businesses alive? This is a liquidity crunch for every company because so much has been shut down, and much of the shutdown, a lot of it has been voluntary by companies because they've recognized the danger that being open can pose, and just to make it easier for everybody. But how do they continue paying their employees? How do you maintain, if you're going to take care of the renter, what do you do with the landlord? If the bank is the one that's holding off, what do you do with them? And so the how do you keep people solvent through all of this, whether payments to individuals, payments to companies to keep people employed and and not have to rebuild their company after when things start to pick up again. That's where the government should be focused. How do you keep people solvent through all of this?
In the brief time that we have left, what's the danger if government does more and just ends up spending a lot of money that we don't have?
Yeah, the danger is, the first priority with everything is health. And but we have so much money already going into that, and we see private development happening already. The second danger is the what happens to the economy. The third danger is that if the federal government responds too much and puts more regulations on. We've seen part of the benefit of this of the response has been reducing regulations and reducing barriers to innovation and to meet the needs of what's going on. And the fear is that if the federal government spends too much and puts too many strings on what they're spending, then you're locking down the economy and making it harder to recover, which is the most important thing. And then the other part that worries me, being the budget person who's always focused on dollars, is with a $3 trillion deficit this year and potentially more, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet increasing by nearly doubling, from $8 or $9 trillion. That's a lot that has to be unwound.
Joseph Coletti is senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation. He focuses, as you could tell, on budget and fiscal issues. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
And that's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Please join us again soon for another edition. Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.